Please support the Climate Change and Happiness podcast. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.
Welcome to Climate Change and Happiness, an international podcast that explores the personal side of climate change, your feelings, what the crisis means to you, and how to cope and thrive. And now, your hosts, Thomas Doherty and Panu Pikkala.
Well, hello, I'm Thomas Doherty.
And I am Panu Pikkala.
And welcome to Climate Change and Happiness. This is our podcast, a show for people around the globe who are thinking and feeling deeply about climate change and other environmental issues. And, I'm a therapist and psychologist, and Panu is an emotions researcher. And so we get into the details of the therapeutic side of this and make it relevant for people. And that's going to be our focus today, because we have two special guests who are been doing a lot of work in the climate psychology and climate coping space.
I'm Judith Anderson.
And I'm Tree Staunton.
Yes, and Judith and Tree, we'll give you a chance to say a little bit about where exactly you're coming in from in the UK. But Judith, I'm meeting Judith and Tree for the first time, but I know Panu has worked with Judith and Tree before, and they're all three involved in a recent book that came out, Being a Therapist in a Time of Climate Breakdown, which captures a number of stories from people in the therapy world that are working on climate change issues and supporting the public. So that's our focus today. What is it like from the inside being a therapist, working in a time of climate breakdown? And we'll kind of draw some insights out for you listeners. Panu, do you want to get us started?
Warmly welcome, Judith and Tree, also for my part. Lovely to have this moment to talk about these matters. And the book, which Thomas mentioned, just came out a couple of weeks ago when we are recording this. So we had a webinar online, and it's a fascinating collection of many kinds of writings. But before we dig deeper into that, it would be lovely to know something about your own journeys towards being climate aware psychological professionals. So would you like to share something about that journey, perhaps starting from Judith?
Yes. Well, I was aware of climate change in the distance, and my wake-up was hearing a colleague speak, an eco-psychologist who's also an art therapist, Mary Jane Rust, and she did a talk at a conference I ran with colleagues, and her talk was called Making the Sea Change. It was through that talk that I realized that climate change and obviously associated issues like biodiversity loss and that was going to be the defining issue for our times. And that was about 2006-07. And so I've been involved in the psychological piece that I feel all the psychological professions have to contribute. We don't have all the answers, but we do have a contribution to make with scientists, with all the other researchers and practitioners to be involved in this problem. We've got something to offer.
And Tree, tell us a little bit about your background.
So yeah, I had a background more. I was a peace activist first. I was involved with Greenham Common, and I used to do nonviolence trainings and things like that in my 20s. And I started training as a therapist when I was 30, and naturally kind of gravitated towards a humanistic approach, in which the personal is the political. And also it was a body psychotherapy training, which is based in Reich. So that was a very kind of political perspective coming in. But Judith and I then met through PCSR, which is Psychotherapists and Counselors for Social Responsibility. And so we were working together around about the time you're talking about, 2005, 2006. So, you know, and that involved kind of conferences and interesting. I worked on the newsletter and you were chair. And out of that, I think we became interested in presenting to UKCP about the climate issue. And that happened in 2009 at an EGM, I remember. And I remember at that point feeling incredibly down about it. I had a period where we were actually presenting together and I had to kind of just let you do it, Judith, because, you know, I was just in pieces. I felt devastated by what we were knowing, what we were hearing and finding out and so on. And I think I really felt for some months in quite a depression about the state of things.
Yeah. I mean, this is really classic origin story. You know, I can identify with it and Panu can, and people have their different waking up moments, you know, either in their personal life or through their professional life or hearing someone speak or reading a book or seeing a movie. What about if you, we love to talk about our environmental identity and our values and our deeper kind of background. How about if you go back farther in time in your lives, like where you grew up or where you're from? Do you see some precursors of some of these beliefs and values? That's always nice to kind of ground us a little bit. Either of you have a thought about that,
yeah.
Judith? You're nodding over there, Judith.
Yeah. Well, my dad was an organic gardener, so that's in the 50s, and he was he was quite old then. So But he followed organic gardening before it became fashionable. So I was reared on mainly organic vegetables, which is really lovely and I'm kind of grateful for. Mm. But I think also in my teenage years, I think that was when Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring came out. And that was quite formative. And when I think about... you know, we can sometimes look back at our adolescent poetry with a question mark. But there were one or two things I wrote that kind of showed an ecological sensibility, I think, for both the literal degradation, but also the way it affects our minds. And that there was something I wrote in particular that... I think I had a seed there that then came to life.
I have a very kind of clear memory of reading a book when I was 16. I think it was called Food for a Future. And it was talking about, you know, 20 tons of grain and to make 1 ton of meat. And if we ate the grain, everybody could eat, you know, there wouldn't be a starvation in the world. And I just felt like this is crazy. You know, we all need to stop eating meat. So I became vegetarian when I was 16. And that kind of kicked off a whole kind of social justice consciousness in me that continued really. I didn't know anyone else who was vegetarian at that time. I lived in Guernsey, which is a very small island in the Channel, the English Channel. I didn't know anybody who was vegetarian. It was obviously way before vegetarianism was a thing. But that was my beginning of consciousness raising.
Yeah, it's beautiful. What are you thinking about, Panu, over there?
Yeah, thanks for sharing all that. And it testifies to the interconnectedness of many justice issues. As we have often talked about in this podcast also, the climate issues are not just about something in the air, but they are affecting our social relations and people's lives in profound ways. So that's also something that comes up when listening to your stories. And I know that you've been active in many psychological circles. You mentioned some of them, and the Climate Psychology Alliance features prominently there. And this book has a third editor, Caroline Hickman, who has also been discussing with us in this podcast. And I know that all the three of you have had this mission of trying to get more psychological professionals on board or becoming aware of what's going on. So was that the major motivation behind this book, and what's the sort of origin story of the book, Judith?
I also wanted to add, we had a fourth editor, Jenny O'Gorman, and she bought she's a younger woman than the three of us, and they brought a really important contribution and very. Mm-hmm. So we were approached by Routledge, a colleague of mine who had founded Climate Psychology Alliance. Paul Hoggart, who's another writer in this field, was approached by some publishers, and he passed that invitation on to me. And we started the book really in quite a democratic way. I sent out a call for people who might want to join me in editing. And then we had a small team together, and we put a call out to members of CPA, did they want to write chapters? And it was only after we'd looked at those contributions that we thought we need more. So we invited Panu to write a chapter and some other people invitation. And I think one reason the book is important is because it does represent the work of Climate Psychology Alliance very much, which is to have a very nuanced approach and a systemic approach to climate distress and its solutions, if you like. I mean, that's just a summary. So it isn't simply, oh, well, if you get more active, you'll treat your anxiety. We know it's much more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
And we also wanted very much to give the reader, who we hope will be a climate curious practitioner, mm-hmm. a lot of ideas to think about, a lot of ways of thinking about how they can work with people with climate distress. But also to perhaps rediscover their own political sensibilities. And there are several chapters that do this.
Mm.
Yeah, and just a process point for the listener. And this is also helpful for the therapists, who are also individuals and citizens who are figuring this out in their own life, and they have their own emotions, right? So there's a popular term of eco-anxiety, which is a kind of a pop culture term, and it means a lot of things to different people. But you know, I think when we get into the professional realm, we use a term like climate distress, because it's a more general term that could imply someone feeling, could be anxious, obviously, but you could also feel confused or scared or depressed or despairing or somehow guilty or complicit, all that complex of feelings, right? So that's what we mean by climate distress. And so I know from in the therapy room, all that's present, and sometimes it's unpacking of that. So trying to help the therapist to understand it isn't just anxiety. That's just maybe the tip of the iceberg, you might say.
I was thinking as you were talking as well, Judith, about how some therapists will suggest people do action as a way to deal with the anxiety. Their you know, feelings, and that is really circumventing, but also it often results in people having burnout, mm-hmm. Because they're not resourced enough. I live in Stroud, which is where coincidentally the Stop Ecocide project started here in 2017, and then XR started here in this town in 2018, and so. You know, a huge kind of movement of action, but also then lately they came to needing to be resourced and wanting to set up kind of more resourcing for themselves. So it kind of feels like the activists and the therapists have to kind of meet in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and see what's needed. So I think in our book, we wanted to include the voices of young people.
Mm.
That's been a really important part of the book for us, hasn't it, Judith?
Yeah.
Some of those obviously were people who said they had gone through their own dark time and come through to some kind of activism, as we heard at the book launch. So, yeah, I think those two kind of meeting has been really important, and they meet in our book as well.
Yeah, I think that's been, I mean, what's really fun about this work is that it's evolving in real time. You know, I've been doing this work in a similar, or even slightly longer maybe than some of this time frame we've been talking about, and just seeing how it's changed over the years. Early on with the eco-psychologists in the 90s, it was really just making the claim that these concerns about the climate weren't just psychological problems because I had authority issues with my parents. You know, they're actually real issues that are valid, you know. So that was a victory. And then, you know, this idea that eco anxiety is a normal feeling. It's anxiety isn't a problem per se. It's adaptive, and so not all eco anxiety is a disorder or anything like that. That was really helpful for people. And then the idea, yes, taking action is helpful. But then, of course, the idea that you know, just rushing into action willy-nilly without any preparation can backfire and actually make people feel worse because long-term environmental actions can include at least as many failures as successes when you're trying to make structural change. And so if you don't know that going into it, you're actually just setting yourself up for failure. Mm. So that big insight is really, I think, a current idea that's getting more nuanced. One thing I like about the British approach, as opposed to, say, the U.S., there is more of a psychoanalytic, psychodynamic style that's kind of woven into more mainstream therapy. And so the idea of our defense mechanisms, I think, is really helpful, that you all talk about in several places in the book, that we do defensive things to kind of assuage our anxiety. And if you do kind of immature or really kind of defenses that aren't very helpful, they don't work as well as more sophisticated ways, right, to deal with our anxiety. So I think that's where that more nuanced conversation about action comes in. Does that ring true?
I also think another thread through Climate Psychology Alliance, and therefore in the book, is the discipline of psychosocial studies, which combines the systemic with the psychoanalytical thinking. So we're looking very much at the kind of concepts which are societal rather than individual, like the idea of socially constructed silence, where people may try and mention climate change in a social setting and immediately somebody else will change the subject. Or, you know, it's as if you've made a bad smell in the room when you mention climate change. And,
I remember one of the voices at our launch said she was a very bad dinner guest these days.
Yeah.
Because she was always trying to raise it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, going back to our impetus for the book, one of the impetuses certainly was that through our therapeutic support system, we were hearing that therapists were not, clients were coming and saying that the therapists had not responded well. And we heard that so often that it really felt important to be giving more input for therapists.
Yeah, that's so socially constructed silence. So, you know, people talk about denial. And that's a term that gets thrown around, and there's different ways to use that. I mean, there's obviously frank propaganda and denial that's happening on the part of bad actors to really stifle change. But this is more subtle denial, right? This is more, like you say, don't talk about this. It's not a proper topic for our dinner, and it keeps people isolated, which is one of the biggest risks for eco despair is isolation, right? So it's that. It's that garden variety denial that's just so much a part of our lives. We don't even know it exists until someone actually raises our consciousness about it. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the way it goes? I mean, we take it for granted that you don't talk about these things until suddenly someone has a wake up call.
There's a nice phrase that comes from the work that reconnects thinking, which is the business as usual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think what's really important in what you've said, Thomas, is that even those of us who are passionate about this can still have part of ourselves that live with business as usual, you know. And of course, some of that's really important. We do need to get on with our lives and have our families and our holidays and our, hopefully with eco-awareness. And so there is, it's holding that balance between the times where it is the really healthy thing to switch off, and it's important to switch off, to have fun with friends, to whatever. But also to be mindful that we ourselves can be drawn into a disavowal of what's going on. What do you think about that, Chief?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking that one of the things that you bring, Panu, about grief and the models of grief is really important as a kind of way in, because I can feel that this concept of denial, beginning with denial, is really helpful, because for me, it's always felt like, but the facts are there. Why aren't people seeing it? You know, there's a enormous frustration about the denial in our culture. And when I view it as a step in the grief process, it makes it a lot easier for me to tolerate.
Yeah, thanks for raising that up and all the discussion there. And in the process model, which we have been discussing here, my attempt to do a simple but somewhat nuanced grab of what's going on, I chose the word distancing to depict both sort of benevolent and helpful distancing, and then it can go into avoidance and denial also. So it's this tricky balance we have to seek. And Judith, you mentioned the work that reconnects, so that's a thread connecting some of this earlier eco-psychology thing that Thomas mentioned with the book also, because coming from Joanna Macy and Molly Young-Brown and other people working at the work that reconnects, there's really pioneering work around our emotions about the state of the world, so including both ecological aspects and threats of war and so on. So it's very good, I think, that there is a chapter explicitly drawing on from that, but of course there's influences from that broad work visible in many of the chapters. And the book has 5 sections, so there's chapter numbers, and then these voice texts, which you have been mentioning, bring, as the name goes, different voices, and they are also spread out through the book. But would you like to say something about the structure of 5 parts in the book that's linked to major themes, of course?
Tree, do you want to go with that, or shall I?
I was going to ask you, because you did it at the launch so well.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's good. I have the book in front of me. We start with the context, with a title, The Trouble We're In. And we had a climate scientist from the US give a very engaging summary of the climate science. And then myself and a colleague outlined both the mental health aspects, the impacts of climate change, of trauma and increased temperature, trauma through floods or fires, and then talking much more about how we manage this, all the different varieties of eco-distress and how we defend ourselves against that. We had a lovely chapter by somebody from South Africa facing thirst. That was one of our voices. And then we had a very important chapter for us on systemic understandings. And we brought in 3 or 4 different experts on this, hoping that for our reader, at least one of them would help turn them on to have a systemic understanding in their practice. And then a very important chapter on the climate-aware therapist, including some research, a PhD thesis on why therapists don't talk about climate change, even when their clients mention it, and the kind of sidestepping of these little mentions.
Yeah.
Side mentions, that's right.
The side mentions, yeah. Side mentions that she said.
Yeah, and some case studies, and a beautiful chapter about the effect of climate change psychologically on young people by Caroline Hickman, who you know and has spoken here. That's where Panu's chapter came in on climate grief and climate sorrow. And you too, Tree, had done some thinking spaces with some students and other therapists about about bringing climate change into the consulting room, but also the body aspect of that. And then we had a focus more on the ecological, bringing in thinking from Leslie Davenport and Nick Totten, who's a very important writer in this field, and some others. Mm-hmm. Kelvin Hall, who's a UK writer, spoke very much about that contact with the other than human. It's a lovely, important chapter. And then moving into these...
Really. And Kelvin is actually a horse whisperer.
Yes.
He works with horses in therapy. Yeah.
And then very much thinking about the approaches that perhaps have their roots in therapy but aren't therapy, and can be conducted by people who aren't therapists. And so there's a lovely chapter on climate cafes, which you may know about, which is a very simple, hospitable space where it's safe for people to talk about their climate feelings. Mm-hmm. There's social dreaming, which is another lovely way of bringing dreams together and letting the dreams of each person speak in the collective. Of a held session, and also the work that reconnects. And then there's a chapter on a particular project we do within Climate Psychology Alliance, which is called Through the Door, which is the idea of therapists taking their minds off the immediate consulting room, individual work, but stepping outside the consulting room, which is what you're doing here with these podcasts. That's another way of going through the door. There are therapists who work with asylum seekers in allotments or something like that, gardens. Mm-hmm. All the different ways that we can get sort of loosen up our identity of one-to-one in the consulting room or one in a group in a consulting room. And it's a particular workshop that we offer people to engage in that inner process of what it means to shake up your identity as a therapist.
That was really well said, Judith, a great spectrum of the book. And it's just really nice. For the listeners too, it's, you have to understand that this work is difficult. And I know, having been an editor, and that was a labor of love. I know getting that book out was difficult for you all. It was a long process and challenging. So it's really nice to celebrate that book and just be thankful that all that word is out. And, for us to talk here today is really helpful for us personally, I think, at least for me, to kind of connect, and be validated in the work that I'm doing. So this is such an important part why we do this podcast, is that the personal connection with people that, and it's different because, the culture words are different from the US and the UK and Finland. So we have to translate even amongst ourselves some of the acronyms we use and all that sort of stuff. But, the general underlying sentiment is really universal, and it's really so important to tap into that. So, if you're feeling, isolated, this podcast can help you, feel less isolated, but, it's really finding your tribe, finding your tribe in the world as well. I just want to kind of surface that process part of what we're doing here.
Would you like to share some of the important ideas or thoughts and feelings that came up for you when working with this book? Either in relation to the text you wrote yourself or reading the other stuff. So what comes to mind as some things which were striking for you, perhaps starting from three?
Yeah, I mean, one really important thread for me has been to do with the work of regulation in bringing in standards for training for future therapists. Mm. And I've written about that in my chapter. But it was a long piece of work, about 5 years, to get the environmental awareness standards into our standards of education in the UK Council for Psychotherapy, who are our regulator. And within that, it's felt like now future therapists will have to have training in environmental awareness. That is the context that we're training people. So we can do a lot of, you know, CPD and things like that for people who've, you know, been trained a while back. But all the future therapists we're training, we are going to be training them, giving them input. And it feels a really, really important and, you know, timely kind of thing to be happening. So I'm really pleased about that. I think it's something that therapists are both wanting and anxious about, approaching this, not knowing, you know, how to respond. So I'm hoping that a lot of the chapters we have are going to really guide and help people, give them ideas, give them inspiration. There's real case studies as well, so that can really flesh it out and help them to find their own way in dealing with these issues.
What about you, Judith? You know, what, you know, we're always learning ourselves all the time. What were some of the, did you add a few more layers of your own, you know, knowledge or insight as you went through this?
Yes, I think people have used the word tapestry about the book, and I think there was a weaving together that was part of the task of creating the book, seeing which chapters fitted together but not putting them in little silos, you know, because they all connected. And of course, it was hard work and frustration. You know, you've mentioned the frustration. But I think as it came together, there was a real sense of having actually done something very important for the profession, I hope, and we hope. And there was a way in which the launch meeting that we had.
It's nice to be able to read it.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a launch. At the launch meeting, I think there was something also about the launch.
It, as opposed to editing.
Yes. Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, actually reading it as a reader instead of as an editor. That was, yeah, that's been lovely.
Yeah.
And it was almost at the launch meeting, the book came alive. It was a bit like the baby got born, and you could see that it did wriggle its toes because we got the different authors to speak with each other as well. And some of them hadn't met each other, but they had conversations or spoke about each other's chapters. Mm. And that was rather special.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I really think there's more good to come because, yeah, as these, you know, as we change the business as usual, and as young therapists come in without some of the unconscious, you know, barriers to speaking about this, and it's normalized, then I foresee, and even with things that I'm working on and you're all working on, is these really fascinating connections that are going to be made now between all these therapy silos and different therapy styles. I mean, I think it's going to be a renaissance of kind of eco and climate therapy in the next decade as more of the mainstream academic programs all take on this challenge, because they've been given permission, you know, to deal with this. And unfortunately, it's going to be driven by actual disasters that people are experiencing and the urgency of this. But I think there's going to be a renaissance of climate therapy where it won't just be a bunch of outside voices crying out in the wilderness about this, but, you know, people in normal classrooms just talking about this. It will become more of the norm, just like green buildings and things are more of the norm and building, you know, in buildings and things like that. That's where I draw some hope as well.
Yes, it is inspiring. And already now I'm meeting young scholars who have been able to read good kinds of integrative writings as part of their studies. So already in 10 years, the situation is very, very different than it used to be. Well, Thomas was already also writing about these things 10 years ago, but nowadays for a student, it's much easier to get at least good writings, in some places also education, and so it's going to get things forward. And this reluctance is an interesting topic, and the combinations of both wanting to know and know how more, and at the same time being reluctant. And sometimes physical spaces are good in that regard, because it's more difficult to escape if you have gotten there or your body has gotten you there. And hopefully the book might serve also that purpose. So it's a physical thing, and perhaps somebody can give it as a present to a colleague who is both feeling hesitant and partly motivated at the same time.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate it. We have to come toward a toward a closing. But I think we covered our mission of hearing about you all and your background and some insights from the book and putting it into some context for the listener. Judith and Tree, where do you see yourself going next, either personally or professionally with this work? I'm just curious, as much as you want to share or as much as you understand, where do you think your next adventures will lie?
Yeah, well, I have two different steps. Rather crazily, I've taken on another book project, and I'm co-editing this time with a environmental psychologist from the Philippines, and it's a broader mental health professions, public health, but I'm including eco-psychology and climate psychology in that book. But I've been chair of Climate Psychology Alliance, and I'm stepping down from that. So doing less administration to do with the organization. And so appreciating the welcome you've given this book through this podcast.
Yeah, thank you. And for myself, I've recently stepped down from being director of a training institute here in Bath. But I'll be teaching a course in that training on the ecological self and climate breakdown. And that will be that's been accepted by the university who accredit our course. So that will run next year for the first time.
Neat. Well, thank you very much, Judith and Tree, and listeners, for spending some time with us. You're all at your evening, so have a great evening. I'm starting my day here. But listeners and Tree, Judith, Panu, be well.
Take care. Thank you, Tree and Judith.
The Climate Change and Happiness podcast is a self-funded volunteer effort. Please support us so we can keep bringing you messages of coping and thriving. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.